when I was an adolescent, mostly out of gleeful curiosity, but also because my mom and I liked being naked. I mean that we just liked the naturalness of it. At Black's Beach, we quickly became bored after seeing that most of the other beachgoers were older gay men. Any shred of feeling risque or sexy because we were nude on that beach quickly evaporated. My mother understood that posing nude could be a celebration of the female form, not just the culmination of male fantasy. Yet as the days crept forward, my doubt grew. 2 days before the shoot, I got into bed and called my agent. Exasperation barely concealed his fury. "No one says no to Helmut Newton," he said. I had embarrassed the agency and myself. A few weeks later, I got a surprising call from my modeling agent. Mr. Newton was shooting a calendar for Lavazza, the Italian coffee company, and wondering, what if I wasn't completely nude, but just topless? Not only hadn't I blown my moment, but I didn't have to compromise in order to grab it. I was glad and relieved that they still wanted to work with me, especially as I was still feeling a bit like a chicken for turning the other job down, especially at the last minute. The atmosphere in Milan at the time in the early 1990s was much more liberal than in America. Italy, Catholicism notwithstanding, was much less puritanical than the United States, and overt images of female sensuality and sexuality were much more prevalent in magazines than on TV. Women with fully nude breasts nursing infants in commercials for baby bottles or formula were commonplace on Italian TV. It was also a time before the internet. Things you did in photos couldn't haunt you and follow you in the same way. More than exploitive, the atmosphere seemed to be one that celebrated the female form and equated breasts with femininity and motherhood. Often all but the cracks of buttocks were exposed in thong bikinis and on beaches along the Mediterranean and Adriatic seas. Grandmothers and teenagers and everyone in between bathed and sunbathed topless. Even excursions in Sardinia with Daniele's family proved eye-opening. So the compromise, the willingness to show my breasts, seemed an easy one. I mean, if even Daniele's mom could go topless, then surely I could, to work with an artist like Helmut. I didn't regret refusing the first job with him, but I was left with a feeling that I had missed a really great opportunity, not only for my career, but also as an artistic experience. At the time, as now, pretty girls were a dime a dozen, and most of them didn't have the extra handicap of being brown or having a scar 7 inches long down their arm. Retouching was still not an option for almost all but Vogue covers back then. Models poured out from every residence and hotel. Milan was a first stop while building your portfolio, and if you didn't want to do some job, there were lines around the block of starving girls who would, and with a smile. The other motivating factor was that this time the job was not for a private commission, but for a Lavazza calendar. Lavazza is one of the oldest companies in Italy. Like Pirelli, they commission great photographers to shoot an annual pictorial calendar. So I guess the coffee company didn't require full bush. Not only would I not have to put my nether regions on display, but people would also actually see my work with Newton. Daniele drove me to Monte Carlo. The shoot was in a suite at the Grand Hotel. When we arrived, I went upstairs, and Daniele sat on the hotel patio, reading Corriere della Sera. I reached the suite only to find that one of my closest friends, Antonio Gazzola, had been booked as the makeup artist. His presence was a good omen. In those early days, he was somehow always there at the right moment. Backstage, he used to whisper to me in Italian that I was just as beautiful as all those other models and that my scar made me special. He knew how anxious I was about the scar and would tell the stylists they didn't have to worry about putting me in short sleeves because he would make the scar disappear. Of course, they always put me in long sleeves anyway. Now, though, he left the scar alone because Mr. Newton didn't mind it, or so I'd heard. Antonio was finishing up when Mr. Newton came in to say hello. He treated me gently and kindly, as a grandfather might. He spoke about his wife, a comfort to a girl about to spend an hour topless with a strange man in a hotel room. I began to feel at ease in my own skin. Then he caught a glimpse of my arm. "What have you done?" he gasped. I began to panic. After the agony of turning down his first offer, the thrill of a second chance, and the years of wondering whether my scar was a deal-breaker, whether the accident had any permanence, Mr. Newton's reaction could be the ultimate rebuff, the moment at which my wondering whether I could make it as a model was met with a definitive, "No, you cannot." "Didn't they tell you about my scar?" The words barely escaped my mouth. "Yes, yes," he said, "but why have you erased a part of it? You've ruined the beauty of it. Antonio, get your paints out and restore that mark to what it was." I couldn't believe it. I can still remember Antonio smiling with a brush between his teeth as he touched up the scar, adding wine-colored lipstick to the lightened area. "Crazy business," he murmured under his breath. While I was there, Mr. Newton booked me right away for Big News 2. In these photos, my scar, not my boobs, was front and center. I felt so comfortable with this man. So oddly safe. And when I posed for a picture for Big News 2, you could see only the side of my face in the Polaroid he showed me. The scar was the star. The Lavazza calendar I wouldn't see for ages yet, but he did send me a print of my own Big News portrait. Antonio knew what I didn't. When the designers found out I had shot with Helmut Newton because of my scar, not in spite of it, they would all want to use me. Already, grunge was in, and models with tattoos and piercings were showing up in American ads for Calvin Klein, and Europe often followed America's lead. Antonio said Helmut would give everyone in Milan and Paris the courage to use me without camouflaging my scar. He was right, and it helped, I'm sure, that my agent milked the shoot for every drop. "Oh, did I mention she just shot with Helmut? That he loved her, that he rebooked her on the spot?" I was soon booked for an 18-page shoot for Italian Elle, and I shot Roberto Cavalli's first campaign with Aldo Filai. I was booked for many shows in Paris that season, from Ungaro to Sonia Riquiel. At the shows, stylists still checked my sleeves, but now they were checking to make sure the sleeves were short so that everyone would know who I was under all that makeup. Bigger jobs presented more opportunities to improve as a model. I learned how to walk from the legendary runway agent Piero Piazzi. "You walk great," he told me, before essentially advising me to change everything I was doing. "I shouldn't move my shoulders or my head, just my hips." I had been overdoing it, walking the way my young daughter does today when she pretends to model. Gradually, I got better at the strange craft of modeling. I learned to hold my body in a nonchalant way for editorials in that 90s grungy attitude that seemed to be screaming, "I don't care if you take my picture." I learned to move in a way that made the clothes swing and look fun on the runway. I also began to understand how to make my body seem slimmer and longer in lingerie and swimsuits on film. My growing success came in part from Mr. Newton's photos, but also from my newfound confidence, which his embrace provided. All of a sudden, booking agents at castings were excited to see me. The spring in my step showed in my work. For the next 4 years, I lived most of the cliches that come with modeling success. There I was, partying on yachts, going to conspicuously cool restaurants, and heading to Ibiza for the weekend. I'd awake on a boat with Daniele, parked near just a few others in the Mediterranean Sea, and go to the prow wearing only my bikini bottom. I knew that men and women on the other boats might see me, and if I saw someone watching, I might turn so my scar was actually visible. Like a string of pearls, my scar became adornment. Almost overnight, it had transformed from a stain into a sort of talisman, a source of power and confidence. Today, I love my scar. It's so much a part of me. I wouldn't remove it even if a doctor could wave a magic wand and erase it from my arm. I've started seeing my body as a map of my life. I can tell a story about every imprint life has made on my skin. The mosquito bites on my back, from when I slept under the Sardinian sun, the summer I first fell in love with Daniele. The scrapes on my leg from the rocks in the Cuban Sea during the filming of my first movie. In her introduction to the book Women by Annie Leibovitz, Susan Sontag asks, "A photograph is not an opinion, or is it?" I believe it most certainly is. A photograph can change the way you look at yourself, though it's more complicated than that. Perhaps it was under the right light, or through the right lens, that I really saw myself for the first time. I have Helmut Newton to thank for that. People have told me that my scar makes me seem more approachable, more vulnerable. Ironically, the greatest gift fashion has given me is the courage to expose that most vulnerable part of myself. By facing the shame of my own body's disfigurement, I was able to liberate myself from that shame, and instead, draw confidence from my scar. Chapter 8. I never decided to stop modeling. By 1997 or so, I was getting bored and less ambitious. I would work only if I needed the money, but I had no healthy desire to really make as much money as I could. And it's hard to get anywhere with modeling if your look goes out of favor with fashion and its trends. I was not a waif. I once got fired from a Sonia Rykiel show because I gained too much weight between seasons. I was bored, and it seemed modeling was bored with me, too. Fortunately, another career began to take shape. Because I was a foreigner who spoke Italian, a relative novelty, I was a soundbite favorite of the news crews that covered the fashion shows for the style-conscious Italian media. Eventually, Rai Television asked me to join the cast of Domenica Inn, Italy's version of the Today Show. I asked the director about showing my scar on TV. "Everyone knows you have a scar," he said. "Don't cover it up." I spent every Sunday for 6 months on live Italian TV in Rome and lived the rest of the week in Milan. The show provided a sort of training ground for every TV job I've done since. Each live show lasted 6 hours, and it aired without even a 5-second tape delay. The anxiety this induced motivated me. I could finally make use of my mind. Sure, I was more Vanna White than Katie Couric, but at least I finally had a job where the goal wasn't to shut up and just look pretty. Plus, these were those heady pre-internet days when a slip-up wouldn't make it around the world in a matter of hours. No one from back home could even watch the show. The producers played up my role as the screwball comedian foreigner still learning the language. I had my own segment on the show called Parole a Parole, meaning word for word. I had to attempt to provide the definition of a difficult Italian word, and an elementary school student would get to guess whether I was right or wrong. In my dressing room, I had hundreds of letters from kids, vying for the honor. The producers loved that sometimes my Italian would fail me. By then, I could speak the language rapidly and intelligibly. I just happened to speak a strange pidgin dialect that was part cab driver, my unofficial teachers, and part profane fashionista, thanks to Daniele and his friends. This occasionally made for exciting television. When one of the show's other hosts teased me on air, I teased back, attempting a gentle insult like jerk, but accidentally using the word stronzo, which essentially means piece of shit. The slip-up earned me a clip on Blob, the Italian version of Talk Soup, a show so popular it spawned a verb, blobato, as in mi hanno blobato, meaning they blobbed me. Soon after, a film agent signed me on and cast me in an Italian costume drama set in Cuba at the time of the conquistadors. They needed an exotic girl type who spoke a bit of Spanish to play a Cuban native. Never mind that I had gone from the high art world of Helmut Newton to a period piece that had cast a Tamil woman as a Cuban, quote, savage, topless in a loincloth, though I insisted they give me hair extensions that would cover my breasts. Never mind that the people who populated pre-Columbian Cuba didn't speak Spanish. I couldn't exactly be picky. This was my first acting gig, 5 long years after graduating from Clark with a degree in theater. I was thrilled. More roles followed, including another in a miniseries where I played a swashbuckling Malaysian princess from the 19th century and a guest role on an Italian TV series with Nino Manfredi where I played a character that IMDb dubbed Indian Lady. I hadn't made it big, but I did feel like I was making it. I liked acting better than modeling. I loved being on set. With the PAs, the cameramen and grips, the hairdressers and costumers and producers and directors. I loved that our pre-packed lunches included a small plastic container of red wine, like those little plastic juice cups with foil tops they give you on airplanes. Even craft services was better in Italy than anywhere else. I liked acting better than modeling for a number of reasons. It was more stimulating, but beyond that, it didn't feel like a blatant exercise in selling something. I wasn't exactly doing Shakespeare in the Park, but for the first time since college, I felt the satisfaction of coming together with others, all of us with the same script in hand, bringing to life something bigger than any one of us could achieve on our own. The best modeling and photography does tell a story, of course. But with acting, I felt that I had the chance to tell a story that unfolded, to be part of a narrative that changed over time and provoked in the viewer a myriad of emotions beyond the brief reaction provoked by a still image. I also loved meeting so many talented technicians on the set. I was curious to learn about how they approach their work, and I wanted to learn from them how I could be better at mine. My director on Dominica Inn, Michele Guardi, taught me as much about improvisation as I had learned in 4 years of college. So when the Food Network offered me the opportunity to host a show, I jumped at it. I had just published my first book and was eager to figure out what to do next. Even though it wasn't an acting job per se, it was about food and I couldn't wait to get back on a set. Little did I know that slowly, while waiting for that big break in acting, I'd actually become good at the work I'd found I loved. The experience I had on Padma's Passport and then Planet Food would later be topped by Top Chef, which would wind up being the perfect mix of the things I loved. Travel, we went to a new city every season and another for finale. Food, I learned from the best. And hosting on television. Something that by the time I started, I had ample practice at. Part of what I love so much about the Top Chef experience is that because it travels from city to city, much like the movies I filmed, the set really feels like a big circus, an improbable place built quickly out of nothing, and just as easily dismantled and stored for the next adventure. It's especially unlikely given how complex the set is. The Top Chef set is divided into two major parts. There's the part you see on camera, the kitchens and judges' table, and the other sites like the pantry sporting the Top Chef logo. And there's the part you don't see. Wherever we're filming, whether we're in the desert or the rainforest, the production staff sets up a control room, or as we all call it, Video Village. Video Village is where the elves work. Magical elves, in fact. Or at least that's the name of the production company that puts on the Top Chef circus. These are the people who make the show the success it is. Video Village migrates depending on the shoot location each day. It winds up in some pretty janky places, an alleyway near a dumpster, a muddy field, a parking lot next to a construction site. If you show up on the set and wonder why there's a tent in the middle of the sidewalk, you've found Video Village. Inside, there's a low hum. People sit and hunch in front of laptops and tablets, jotting down time codes and snatches of dialogue for post-production. Audible above the hum are the voices from the shoot, emanating from the monitors. Tom critiquing a sauce, the contestants fretting in the stew room, where they sit and wait before we send one of them home. There's a bank of a dozen or so monitors, each showing a different setting or angle. Two people always sit in front of the monitors, staring at them and talking, it seems, to no one in particular. The most vocal of the two is Paul Starkman, Top Chef director and resident mensch. In the bottom of each screen in front of Paul is the name of a different camera operator. Like a high-tech puppeteer, Paul controls filming by calling out their names, followed by his instructions, his eyes seemingly everywhere at once. "Send them in, Brenda," Paul says, as he watches one of the monitors as the chefs trudge single file towards judge's table. "Give me Emerald. Okay, zoom in. Stay on Brooke. She gives a better reaction. Look at that. Tom's taking tickets. That's good. That's good. Eric, give me Padma. Padma. Padma, goddammit!" In this way, the storyline takes shape. As Paul gauges the unscripted judge and contestant reactions, he looks for theater and truth. Paul hears John Besh say, that's a difficult dish to pull off. In that line, Paul sees a dramatic element, snapping his fingers and exclaiming, ooh, that's good. When a contestant stands out in a way that's good, bad, or both, Paul lets it guide him. Is Dale the story tonight? He might wonder aloud. Next to Paul sits the show's executive producer. Although we've had several others, for the past several years, it's a woman named Nan Strait, who is the little voice in my ear. While Paul commands, Nan quietly guides me. I hear her often in my earpiece, helping to play effective host and occasionally protecting me, and therefore the show, from myself. I might be sitting beside Tom or Wolfgang Puck when my must-prove-I-belong-here reflex kicks in, and I take a stab at culinary erudition. Suddenly, there's Nan to tell me, as only she could. "Hey, Padma, save it for PBS. Or, "That was great, but 3 million people just changed the channel." She's also there to remind me that not everyone at home knows all the food words we're tossing around inside our little bubble, where we all know the difference between brunoise and julienne. When I launch into praise of the African spice called grains of paradise, without identifying what the heck it is, I hear Nan bring me back to the real world. "All right, for those of us cowpokes who watch the Super Bowl and make Velveeta nachos," she says as gently as she can you explain what the hell grains of paradise are?" When I do, Tom, not knowing I've been instructed to hold forth, looks at me like he wants to fillet me. I'm not telling him, I'm just looking at him while I tell the people at home. Sometimes keeping my lips moving is part of the job. In my efforts to steer or maintain the conversation among judges to please the producers, I often embarrass myself. I awkwardly toss around chefy terms like expediting and pickup time. I pronounce someone's rendition of the root vegetable salsify delicious while pronouncing the word salsify instead of salsify. I've also at various times rendered quinoa as quinoa and calcium as calcium, thanks to the many accents and languages in my head competing for access to my mouth. Realizing I'm mispronouncing a word always makes me cringe. It's even worse when I do it in front of Thomas Keller and 14 rolling cameras. Nan goes through the scripted parts of the show with me, not just to give me extra practice, but because some of the wording must be very carefully followed. Top Chef is technically a game show and therefore governed by FCC regulations. The contestants are supervised at all times. Their phone calls are monitored. If a contestant talks to me off camera, a producer jumps in to say quietly and seriously, "Please step away from the judge." The tone is such that you almost expect him to follow with, "And please put your hands behind your back." The slightest whiff of collusion is a no-no. I'll be on the set gabbing with a producer, and I'll hear, "Chefs within earshot!" Any talk about the show stops immediately. I'll be in the bathroom stall, and I'll hear, "Chef walking," as a contestant comes into the bathroom with their escort. Who knows, the thinking goes, whether or not I'm on the pot, talking to Gail on the phone about a recipe? Occasionally, the only filming going on is of the chefs in the kitchen. That's when I like to visit Video Village to watch the cooking happen in real time on the monitors. Even though the chefs are typically working in a giant professional kitchen, the scenes conjure up for me the solitude and quietude of cooking at home. The soundtrack is more familiar, too. The low buzz of silence, broken up by the occasional slurp, clinking of spoons, rustling of cotton, the tinny scraping of whisk against bowl. It's a testament to the skill of the producers, cameramen, editors, and the rest of the production team that the show is such a thrill to watch. Because without splicing, cliffhanging commercial breaks, and music, the footage can be decidedly unexciting. Unexciting, but lovely too, the happy tedium of cooking on display. Whether you have an office job or work on a TV set, the days and years pass, and the next thing you know, the people you were thrown together with by chance become more than colleagues. Time fosters connection, and over time, the people on Top Chef have become a sort of second family to me. After I moved out of the home I had shared with Salman, I felt totally rudderless. But the show gave me something to hold on to. It was a real thing that I could be proud of and count on when I had little else. I felt immense gratitude to have a job that required my attention fully so that I was forced to leave my personal heartbreak aside, even if only for the duration of filming. It was the same summer of my divorce that the show received its first Emmy nominations. It hadn't really occurred to me that that might happen. It wasn't even on my radar. But in some important way, our show being taken seriously by the Television Academy made me take myself more seriously, made me sit up and take notice of my own work. Until that point in my career, I had mostly waited for the phone to ring, for someone to give me an assignment, whether it was modeling, writing, acting, or hosting. Awards aren't the reason you do things, or important in themselves. But the Emmy nominations were a turning point. I went from hoping things would work out to seeing that they were working out. I am actually doing this, I thought. Maybe I'm not just flying by the seat of my pants. I didn't want to be passive anymore, personally or professionally. In that moment, I came into being as my real and present professional self. Top Chef and its success gave me the courage to think proactively about shaping my career, and I began to explore what I wanted it to look like. For the first time, I began to consider my goals and my interests in a clearer and more pragmatic light. Until then, I had chased every lead because those were the only opportunities I could see. I had to publish 2 cookbooks and host 3 different food shows before I finally took my culinary hobby seriously and gained a modicum of true professional confidence. It had taken me well into my middle 30s to begin to come into my own, but no matter. I now had a direction to point myself. I began to think about other work I would find rewarding that I could pursue when Top Chef wasn't filming. The greatest gift that Top Chef gave me was the blessing of living intentionally, with agency, and doing what I really loved. Chapter 9. I met the man who would change my life on an accidental date. Rick Schwartz, a movie producer friend, and I had hatched a plan to turn Jhumpa Lahiri's collection of short stories, Interpreter of Maladies, into a movie. Rick set up a meeting with Teddy Forsman, the chairman and CEO of IMG, the global sports and media company, who had deep enough pockets to fund several movies. I suppose to a different sort of person, his name would have at least rung a bell. Not to me. I didn't know anything about the world of private equity, mergers, and buyouts. If I'd owned a bird, I'd have used the business section of the paper to line its cage. I didn't want to go to the meeting. I didn't feel I belonged there. After all, Rick was the brains behind the operation, He was the producer, the guy who understood movie deals and investment and distribution. But Rick insisted. Mr. Forsman might wonder why a Jewish guy from New York wanted to do a film about Indian immigrants. I'd be there to preempt the question, I guess. This was in early May 2007. Although my and Salman's attempt at reconciling had failed for good, and we had decided, for the second time, to divorce, we were still living under the same roof and trying our best to be civil to each other. So I was actually in a cab with Salman when I called Mr. Forsman's office to set up the meeting. Salman gave me a look when he heard me ask for Mr. Forsman. "Teddy Forsman," he mouthed, all arched eyebrows. Salman's reaction made me feel like I should have known about this guy, Teddy. Later, Google filled me in. He had pioneered the leveraged buyout, borrowing money to buy companies, then refurbishing and selling them. He and his partners at Forsman Little made a fortune doing it, and he owned a production company and had recently acquired the legendary agency IMG. He had dated Princess Diana, all of which sounded good to me because we were trying to finance a movie. The next day, I got a call from Teddy. We spent a while chit-chatting. I remember thinking, he can't be such a big deal. I mean, if he's able to spend 20 minutes talking to me. He was available to meet Sunday for dinner, which I thought was an odd day and time for a business meeting. "I'll pick you up," he said. I told him I could probably get there myself, thank you very much. "Were she alive, my mother would be upset if I didn't pick you up," he told me. Whatever, I thought. He's eccentric. I'd just meet him and Rick at whatever restaurant Teddy chose. But 2 days before the meeting, I got a call from Rick. He had to be in Chicago, where he was stuck, doing a movie he was producing with Tim Robbins. He couldn't make it back in time. "No problem," I told him. "I'm sure we can reschedule." "No way," said Rick. "Teddy Forsman isn't an easy man to pin down." "Then does it have to be dinner?" "If he wants dinner, have dinner." From Rick's urgency, you would have thought this Forsman guy was the Pope. I called his office to tell him Rick would be unable to attend the meeting. Unlike the very few big businessmen I'd had brushes with before, whose secretaries handled all logistical negotiations, when I called Teddy's office, I got Teddy. I launched into my best impression of an important movie producer. "Mr. Forsman," I said, "my partner is stuck on another production. On Sunday, it will just be me." "Great," he said. "Where shall I pick you up?" Dinner was mostly a blur. We went to Il Cantinori, a quiet, candlelit Italian restaurant in the East Village. Nervous and tasked with convincing this guy to back us, I managed to inhale my scallopini, while talking a mile a minute about the movie. With every sentence that spilled out, it became clearer to me that the man to whom I was hawking this niche film was the type who'd sooner fund a Spielberg blockbuster. There was nothing about Teddy that read indie or niche. He used the word neat a lot. He seemed to me to be the epitome of the establishment, the very white, very male majority who run corporations, the government, and the world. He wore a sapphire and gold pinky ring with a crest engraved on the stone on the same hand as a Jaeger LeCoultre watch. Halfway through the main course, the conversation took a strange turn. "That house you live in, I only saw one doorbell," he asked. "Do you live there all by yourself?" "No," I said. "I live there with my husband and stepson." I still had my wedding ring on, not ready to accept failure publicly. What's more, I had no designs on Teddy. Dating any man was the last thing on my mind, and I did not want him to know that my personal life was anything but normal and happy. "I thought you were separated," he said. He had read a snatch of gossip about my marriage in a tabloid, a small dose of schadenfreude for the casual reader, but thoroughly gutting to me. Apparently, someone at the Waverly Inn had overheard a conversation about my relationship with Salman being over. As Teddy spoke, my stomach dropped. Not only was I being reminded about my unraveling marriage, but this very private fact was also being delivered by someone I barely knew. Then, after a moment, I understood. I was on a date. "I thought this was a business meeting," I said. "I thought it was odd that you were wearing your wedding ring on a date." "Date? I'm pitching you a movie." "My dear, it's not that you aren't bright and quite a talker," he said, "but this is slightly below my pay grade." I felt like a fool. I hadn't understood the difference between an executive at IMG and the guy who bought IMG. Of course Teddy wouldn't have met with me about my little project. "I'll tell you what," he said, sensing my embarrassment. "You should meet with Rob Dalton, the creative director of IMG, before he goes back to L.A. The only chance I'd have to do so, he said, would be a few days later, when Teddy and Rob would be at Teddy's box at Sotheby's Auction House. "I'll be selling some paintings," he mentioned offhandedly, as if he were telling me to drop by his stoop sale. A few days later, I went to Sotheby's to meet with Rob. Because I felt duped about the nature of my first meal with Teddy, before I headed to Sotheby's, I called Rick and read him the riot act over the phone. He insisted he hadn't sent me to the dinner for anything other than business reasons. I felt further reassured knowing there would be several people from Teddy's office at Sotheby's with him. I'd been to the Great Auction House once before with an art dealer friend. We'd sat on folding chairs shoulder to shoulder with other dealers and spectators, watching paddles rise and fall. It was exhilarating, with slides of the great works up for sale flashing on the screen behind the podium, the auctioneer calling out vast sums of money. I never thought to look up, above the action on the floor. But on the day I went to meet Teddy and Rob, I discovered that above the auction pit, there are boxes where heavy hitters look on in privacy. People who make the strivers downstairs seem like commoners. When I arrived, Teddy was observing an auction for one of his Modigliani paintings. "Come on, Junior," he joked many months later. "You were turned on by all that." "Not at all," I said, doing my best impression of a wealthy dowager. "A man is much more attractive when he's acquiring than when he's unloading." The truth is, Teddy mesmerized me. I felt drawn, not romantically, but almost anthropologically, to his presence. His success, mysterious to me in its particulars until later, provided an intriguing subtext to every sentence and every gesture, however banal. Sitting in that box with him and a gaggle of his colleagues, I felt like I was watching Muhammad Ali have brunch. At Il Cantinori, he had given me his full attention. Here, he was still a gentleman and unfailingly polite, but he handed me off to Rob with a mere sentence. Something like, "Rob, this young lady's got some big ideas and a book about Indians in America." Rob took it from there. I tried to explain why a book of short stories on immigrant Indians in the U.S. would make a great movie. But it was hard to be articulate in that atmosphere. Teddy, meanwhile, was busy unloading a couple of Modigliani paintings. I couldn't understand why anyone would want to do that. Who was this strange creature in black tasseled loafers? I mentioned to Teddy that I was soon headed to L.A. to surprise my mom for Mother's Day. "How funny," he said. He would be heading to L.A. at the same time. "Would you like a ride," he said, "the way I might propose driving a friend upstate?" I stared at him blankly, trying to figure out what the heck he meant. "On my plane," he added, sensing my cluelessness. I'd already bought my ticket, but I couldn't turn down a trip on a private jet, my first ever. Days later, I found myself at a heliport on the eastern reaches of Manhattan. The helicopter took us to Morristown Airport. When we landed, we exited the helicopter directly onto the small runway. Then from there, we boarded Teddy's Gulfstream 5, a gift from the private jet maker for buying, then saving the failing company in the mid-90s. Just walked right up a small staircase and into the plane. No lines, no security, no taking off my shoes. It was exciting. I felt like a child getting on a roller coaster. Inside, instead of the rows of seats I somehow still expected to see, I saw what looked like a cozy living room outfitted with four big chairs facing each other. A small long bar with two crystal bottles of brandy and magazines, and a dining table with plush banquettes that seated four across from the bar. There were three flat-screen TVs total. Toward the back of the plane was another seating area, not the fully reclining seats some airlines sell to first-classers, but two couches that could each seat three and could collapse, I found out later, to become a proper bed, queen size and plush. As Teddy got settled, I tried to play it cool. He had an apartment that could fly. I couldn't help thinking about my mom's first apartment on East 83rd Street. The plane's cabin seemed to be about the same size. Over 30 years had passed since I'd lived in that apartment, since I'd first arrived in New York from India, which now felt more like several lifetimes distant. That flight from Delhi to John F. Kennedy Airport, which had been my first, had brought its own kind of wonder. I had been just 4 years old when my grandparents had put me on a plane, alone, to cross several oceans and continents. A journey that would reunite me with my mother, whom I had seen just once in 2 years. When my grandfather left me at the Delhi airport that October morning, I had on shoes, not a typical feature of my wardrobe at the time, and a bright red wool coat with a hood and a big bow just below the collar. I'd never needed a heavy coat before. My grandfather, however, had been to America and knew true winter. Fastened to the inside of my red coat was a glassine envelope containing a slip of paper with the address of my grandparents' house in Delhi. A sort of return address for me, a little brown and red package. Their phone number and my mother's information were also listed. I can still hear my grandfather reciting the phone number aloud, saying not instead of zero, prompting me to repeat after him. I was excited. I didn't understand where I was going or how long my trip would take, but I knew I'd see my mother again. I flew Air India. The trip, the local bus equivalent of air travel, took me from Delhi to Cairo, Cairo to Rome, Rome to London, and finally London to New York. I loved every minute of it. The plane's interior was baby blue, and the stewardesses, the supermodels of the 70s, were impossibly glamorous, wearing large bindis on their foreheads, bouffant hairdos, and printed silk saris. They strode the jetliner's aisles, calling out, "Coffee? Tea? Juice?" in their poshly accented English. Between flights, I watched their saris flutter as they walked briskly down the jetways, each woman carrying a pink Samsonite beauty case. I sat near the front of the plane, with the other kids flying solo. The stewardesses plied us with coloring books and little paper puppets of the airline's mascot, a mustachioed Maharaja wearing a red Nehru jacket. One older girl who made the trip with me through many planes and airport gates wore braids in her hair, bottle cap glasses, and a yellow plaid dress with a ruffle at the bottom and a bow at her back. Very Holly Hobby. Her trip was traumatic. At the gate in Heathrow, I watched her throw up on the back of her chair, staring as the vomit cascaded down the polyurethane. I wasn't nauseous. I spent my trip marching up and down the plane aisles. I was excited to be flying in the sky, gazing at downy clouds outside my airplane window. I felt elated to be on my way to America and to be reunited with that most glamorous and elusive member of our family, my mother. I didn't know then, of course, that the crossing from New Delhi to New York was more than a crossing of oceans and continents. It was a crossing of cultures, of lifestyles, of ways of being and knowing. I would be debarking in a new world. I would never be fully at home again in India or ever fully at home in America. I couldn't look back, even if I had thought to. As Teddy's plane rumbled into the sky and we settled into our chairs, the disparity between the lives we both had led really struck me. I had a sudden and strange realization. Beside the pilot and two attendants, we were the only ones aboard. On that first trip with Teddy, the unspoken agreement of the commercial plane ride, talk minimally to your seatmate, if at all, did not apply. So our flight felt a bit like a road trip. Just the two of us, looking for ways to pass the 6 hours it took to reach LAX. We made a game of our conversation. We decided to go back and forth, sharing a story from each year of our lives. I began with my mother's first divorce and decampment, my first flight, and our reunion on Halloween night. I told him of moving back to India a few years later, leaving out the most personal details, and then returning to New York. I told him about moving to LA, modeling in Europe, and my forays in TV. I found myself, for the first time in a long while, recounting my life to someone far removed from it. He wasn't a part of my ever-overlapping worlds of fashion, food, or TV, as many of my friends were. He wasn't a writer, editor, or publisher, as many of Salman's friends were. He was unaffected by the Kool-Aid I had so eagerly drunk. I felt liberated of the self-seriousness that occasionally afflicted my industry's tales of TV shoots and casting calls. And unlike the Bombay-born Salman, Teddy had grown up in Connecticut. He listened to my Chennai stories with particular curiosity. I saw the strangeness of my peripatetic childhood and young adulthood reflected in his face. He told me about his family, his childhood and coming of age, about how he'd supported himself with money he made playing bridge. He told me about his first job out of law school, as a prosecutor for homicide cases. We continued to trade stories until we reached year 36, when I ran out of years. He had 30 more to go. I learned that there was much more to Teddy than business deals. He told me about his friendship with Nelson Mandela, who had given him one of his prized possessions, a replica of the dish Mandela had eaten from inside his Robben Island prison cell, inscribed, "Best wishes to a precious and generous friend." He told me about his son Sia and Everest, South Africans who had been orphaned and whom Teddy adopted and adored. He told me about the children's charity he supported, leaving out information I'd later discover, that he had co-founded the Children's Scholarship Fund, to which he had given $50 million, and which had subsequently raised more than 8 times that amount. Besides that, he also worked with the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, and funded a couple of camps for kids with terminal illnesses. And he conducted an annual fundraiser each summer for still other children's charities. Most people, myself included at first, didn't realize how copious his philanthropy had been. He preferred to give it in a way that didn't involve his name on the side of buildings. "I've got monogrammed towels and golf shirts for that," he'd say. Aside from the final hour of the flight, when Teddy began to excuse himself every 10 minutes or so to make brief phone calls, we spent the entire trip talking. Later he told me that what I thought were important calls to some CEO or board member were actually calls to his pilot, Tom Ritz. It turns out a Gulfstream 5 doesn't really take 6 hours to get to L.A. from New York. "Ritzy," Teddy told Tom, "can you fly around the block a few times?" "We're running low on fuel," Tom joked back. "Make your move already." I didn't fall in love on that plane ride. There is a myth about love, that it happens in an instant, that there must be a spark that generates immediate flames, that the flames must roar right away. When I met Teddy, I was in no emotional state to start a new relationship. I was still reeling from the freefall of my divorce. I had been as high on life as you could get. In love, happy with my career, confident as can be that it would all last forever. And then, in no time, I was alone, nauseated and unsteady from the rapid descent. I approached Teddy with caution. My divorce had highlighted the faults of my relationship blueprint. I was old enough by then to recognize that the principles that had guided my choice of men could have been pulled directly from the She Has Daddy Issues handbook. I never knew my father. Until my 20s, I didn't even know what he looked like. I did have a doting grandfather, however. My beloved K.C. Krishnamurti, or Tata. For more than 3 decades, he worked as a civil hydro engineer in the Indian government. During his heyday in the late 1960s, he managed enough water to control a third of India's power. He was so distinguished in his field that after a short tour surveying hydroelectric plants and dams in America and Canada, he was offered a much higher post by the Canadian government. A devout Brahmin and vegetarian, he politely declined. He figured that as a manager he'd be forced to entertain in his home and serve meat, which he was not prepared to do. Later in his life, when I pressed him, he admitted that he had also declined in order to spare his children yet another move. Despite his success, he was, like most government workers, squarely in the middle class at best. He was born in Kerala in an enclave of Tambrams, slang for members of our Tamil ethnicity and our Brahmin caste. Our family home had long been up north, but when he retired at age 60 in 1977, he moved the family back south to Chennai, called Madras back then, which was the capital of the Indian state of Tamil Nadu. He felt, rightly, that his pension would go further down south. He would also be closer to his relatives, to the ocean, and to the hub of dosas, the savory rice and lentil crepes, made on iron griddles at the vegetarian tiffin halls near the Mylapore temple in Chennai. He often said, jokingly or not, that he wanted to die in the land of his forebears, but still live in a city. So he arrived in Madras rather than Kerala, where he purchased the 2-bedroom, 3rd-floor flat at A7 Bar 5 in the Government Officers Colony Housing, in the neighborhood of Besant Nagar, where I would spend some of the most formative years of my life. KCK had always wanted to practice law. His parents had 9 children, so sending a son to law school was not in the financial cards for them. After a career as a hydro engineer, he could handle the cost. So upon moving to Madras at age 60, he enrolled himself in Anna University to study law. After graduating first in his class, he worked as an apprentice to a younger advocate and eventually took a case on his own, winning insurance money for a widow. He promptly retired from law and ran a tutorial out of our home in arts and letters as well as math and sciences. On Sundays, he tutored any college students who couldn't afford to pay. Everyone knew KCK's flat in Besant Nagar. If you ever got lost going there, you need only walk to nearby Elliot's Beach and ask one of the many young men leaning on their scooters and having a cool drink. KCK's love of knowledge didn't relent even during the last few years of his life. When I'd come home to visit, I'd find him at his desk behind a stack of books. "What are you doing, Tata?" I'd ask. "Working out some physics problems, Pads," he'd reply. He wanted to keep his mind sharp. Mornings of my Madras childhood smelled of steeping coffee, steaming tea, and sandalwood. I'd wake up to the sounds of my grandmother haggling with the vegetable vendor through the window, and of the water being splashed hard by the mugful on the cool marble tile of the bathroom. After bathing, my grandfather washed his own garments, wrung them dry, and hung them in the sun on a clothesline on the veranda. He would anoint his body, once a decathlete but by then rotund with a belly and a grand double chin, with stripes of sandalwood paste and vibhuti, or holy ash, as would most Brahmin men. Then he'd comb back his receding salt and pepper hair with Brill Cream, Pat Riley style. To this day, I can't think of him without conjuring the combined smell of Brill Cream and sandalwood. While the women of the house chased after us to put on our uniforms and collect our books, and to take our tiffin boxes of hot curries and rice for school lunch, while we yanked on our shoes and socks and hightailed it downstairs before the bus stopped honking and left us in the heat and dust, he chanted his morning prayers and slokas on the veranda. Before the sun's heat had reached full force, he'd set off on his daily morning constitutional, accompanied by his carved walking stick and the other retired attorneys in the neighborhood. Of all the people in our family, no two had a tighter bond than KCK and me. He doted on me endlessly, and among his three grandchildren, I was his pet, at least until Rohit, his first grandson, was born. After my mother left for America, he took it upon himself to prep me for our eventual reunion. To my 4-year-old self, it felt like I was an astronaut getting ready for a trip to the moon. Tata was my mission control and the senior officer who had made that voyage and come back to tell about it. He had traveled to the U.S. numerous times and gave me as much information as he could about the gravity and air on this new planet called America. He spoke of tall skyscrapers and something called the subway. He said that children played baseball, not cricket. When I met new people, rather than stay silent and invisible, he taught me to say, "Hello, how are you doing today?" In 1970s India, people preferred children to be seen and not heard. America seemed to require a gregariousness that was not lauded in our culture. Truth be told, he loved America and relished pouring all his accumulated knowledge into his first grandchild. Tata made me memorize all 50 U.S. states alphabetically. He made me memorize the name of Gerald Ford, the then U.S. president. He taught me to sing Old Man River, a 1920s ballad from the musical Showboat, about a dock worker's struggle against the great Mississippi River. Tata loved the song and sang it in a low, slow baritone, doing his best to approximate a black American's southern accent. The song was a metaphor for struggling against the currents of the river of life, as experienced by an African-American stevedore in the Jim Crow South. I wonder if he feared that my mother and I would never be accepted as equals there. Would we be discriminated against like the African-Americans he read about? To his very Indian way of thinking, education was the best defense against this. So he would educate me, as much as he could, on the ways and mores of my adopted culture, and hope that it, in turn, adopted me. He told me stories of how he navigated American restaurant menus to feed his vegetarian stomach in the land of meatloaf and chicken casseroles. He described cooking for his hosts during a business trip and teaching them how to make yogurt rice, of their incredulousness at the possibility of not starving to death on just lentils and rice. They seemed to think that this was the cause of India's poverty, but he assured them that one could feed more people with the milk of a cow than with its flesh. He spoke wistfully of buying hot coffee and a warm donut for 50 cents at lunch counters when there was nothing else he deemed suitable. Tata loved donuts. We had no Indian equivalent of a sweet that size, soft and fluffy, filled with air and cottony starch, shellacked with a sweet white glaze or sprinkled with sugar and cinnamon dust. Donuts were the thing he missed most. He talked of donuts reverently. Tata and his sweet tooth. Tata focused a lot on the food in America. Food was, of course, central to his existence. You could tell by his big Santa Claus belly, which in those days I often slept on at night. But mealtime in the States was when he had struggled most. It was the one facet of American life he, as a Brahmin man, a lacto-vegetarian, could not totally assimilate to or fully enjoy. He told me to be very careful when I ordered food outside my mother's house because there was hidden meat lurking everywhere, even in harmless-seeming soups. You'd be ready to eat some gorgeous, shimmering-hot vegetable soup in the snowy Yankee winter, he'd warned me, and then, just as you closed your mouth to swallow, You would sense a meaty odor in the broth, a dark, sinister flavor no God-fearing soul could consume. Even fruit pies or potato crisps, which I loved and ate by the handful, could be fried in the extracted and liquefied fat of an animal. They called